Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, November 23rd, 2014. We're thrilled to join you again for this unique hour every Sunday night on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and we have a very special show for you tonight. Before we launch into our conversation with Mimi Gurman, I want to thank all of you who are participating in our amazing webinar on Thursday nights on the topic of relationships in the age of ecological apocalypse. How do we love? How do we leave? And we had a very powerful session of the webinar on Thursday night with Jack Adam Weber, as we looked at the kind of emotional and body work that we need to be doing at this time of collapse and extinction. This very excellent presentation by Jack was a beautiful segue into our December 4th session, which is going to be with Frances Weller, who's been on the Lifeboat Hour twice this year, and as most of you know, the focus of Frances's work is grief. So we'll be skipping this coming week because of Thanksgiving, but returning on December 4th to look at grief and love in a culture of congestive heart failure. If you'd like to register for just that single session, or if you'd like to register for the entire webinar and have access to all the recordings, past and future, visit syncast.net. That's syncast.net. And you can take care of all of that there. I don't know about you, but this time of year, my thoughts return to what happened 51 years ago yesterday in Dallas, Texas, namely the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the transfer of power that ensued as a result of it. At the tender age of 18, I was deeply shaken by it because it was happening about the same time that my grandparents were dying. The assassination was obviously a very public death, but the deaths of my relatives were very personal, obviously, and I found myself in a milieu of death that represented my first encounters with death as I was transitioning into adulthood. I don't need to remind any of us that we live in a culture that is extremely jaded about death. In fact, it's a culture that remains infantilized around death, as it is around so many other issues. Some more mature individuals have been fighting for decades for death with dignity, and as a result, we now have 5 states in the U.S. where people can die with dignity. Those are Oregon, Washington, Montana, New Mexico, and Vermont. Recently, national and international media was replete with stories about Brittany Maynard, the 29-year-old woman who went to Oregon to die with dignity in the face of a particularly vicious type of brain cancer that caused her severe seizures and that would have meant a horrific death for her. She chose to end her life on her own terms, and she did so peacefully on Saturday, November 1st. Our guest tonight is no stranger to the Lifeboat Hour. In fact, she's a mainstay here, and usually either Mike or I have invited her on the show to talk about Fukushima and her website, radcast.org. I'm talking about Mimi Gurman, and she has another vocation besides tracking nuclear radiation. She's also a body worker, and I'm going to let her tell you about what kind of body work she does. And perhaps you're thinking, well, what does any of that have to do with Brittany Maynard or death with dignity? I'll let Mimi explain, so I'm going to go ahead and give her the mic. Mimi, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thanks for having me back, Carolyn. I love talking with you, and I love listening to your guests on your show. It's really an honor to be here today. Thank you.
You're welcome. And you know, Mimi, you called me about a week or two before Brittany ended her life to tell me that you'd met her and that you were working with her. So please tell us about that, and please tell us about meeting Brittany and who she was. I know that eventually you met her mom and her husband, so tell us about that as well, please.
Well, it was a surprise to me that I was even working on Brittany, because I didn't know when I met her who exactly my hands were on, other than this woman named Brittany Maynard. I do massage therapy, and I do different kinds of healing work as well. And one day, my client was Brittany Maynard. And I know that it's okay for me to talk about this because Brittany was so forward in discussing her issues with the world to
right.
make death with dignity known, and in her hopes and in my hopes, more widespread and legalized across not just the United States, but the world. So I found that when I met Brittany, I knew of her her pain, physical pain, and I also learned very quickly about her strength. And a friend and I were both working on her family, on Brittany and her family. And when I learned, I didn't know, in fact, the very first time I worked on Brittany's mother with Brittany in the room, Brittany was being worked on with by a friend of mine, I didn't know anything about her story. I just knew that she's a particularly strong woman dealing with a lot of pain. And I learned the second time I met who Brittany was and what she was doing, in Oregon with her mother and her husband. And I was really blown away at having, at just really being able to work with somebody and be with somebody who was this strong and this clear, because these were things that mattered to me in my life and have mattered to me in my life for a very, very long time, culminating with, yes, death with dignity, but also different realms of who we are as human beings and how we live and how we coincide with all different aspects of what life really is. Brittany encompassed all of that. So to be able to be with her and talk with her was one of the greatest honors I've had to date in my life. So during the second meeting with Brittany, she said to me, I was working on her husband and we were all in the same room. Brittany asked me, she mentioned that her birthday was coming up, and of course she wouldn't be here for her birthday. It was, I think her birthday would have just happened. And she was a Scorpio. And her husband, I believe, is a Scorpio. And we started to talk about, she said, what do you think about Scorpios? And I said, well, you know, one of the things that I've learned being a Scorpio throughout my life is that we do come with quite a bit of complexity regarding life and death. From the people I've met, every Scorpio I've met has not shown fear in delving into the subject of death or rebirth or whatever it is on those kinds of levels. Do you know what I mean, Carolyn?
I absolutely do, because I'm sort of a fan of astrology, and the Scorpio is ruled by Pluto, and Pluto's the big dude of the underworld, and it's like going into death, rebirth, transformation constantly.
Yeah, so it was interesting being able to have this talk with her, and that's sort of what I expressed to her. I said, you know, one of the reasons I think that you're so at ease with where you are is because you have no fear. You deal with fear when it comes up. We deal with fear when it arises. We look at it. We're not afraid to look at it, to look in the face of death. For Brittany, far more than I've ever had to. And deal with what it is that we see. You know, how do we want to take this on? And in Brittany's case, we know how she wanted to take it on. And she told me that her husband was so in line with her, that they were working as such a unit with love and compassion and understanding and no fear. It was really, it was one of the best conversations I've ever had with anyone, because we really were in that moment. We were in the moment just being days before she was making that decision to die. And I'm working on her husband while she's talking, and he was so calm. And I knew that their connection together, even in the same room, but I'm sure outside of that room as well, was one of those strong links that we can only hope to connect with in our own lives. At least that's how I felt about it, you know. That
right.
I want to strive to have that connection with my partner, because it's so clear and strong. stronger than anything. Nothing can get in the way and break it. And they had a lot of things that were trying to come in and break their bond and break their strength, and that mm-hmm. is a combination of media and all of these people who don't believe that a person has a right to die by, you know, by their own doing, by their own choice, which isn't, by the way, suicide. And they didn't even have to fight it because their bond was so strong. Love was so strong. Love won. And love always wins.
Absolutely. And I'd like to hear more about your last conversation with Brittany, what you guys talked about, your final hug, and what it was like for you to wait for that fateful Saturday to come.
Well, I was working, and they were getting ready to leave. They were just, you know, paying and on their way out. And I'd wanted to speak with Brittany's mother again. And Brittany said to me that, you know, she was feeling very vulnerable, and it probably wasn't a great time. So I just put out on my end just energy towards her mother, since I knew I couldn't talk to her. And I went over to both of them, to Brittany and her husband, and I hugged them, and I said, I told them that I was grateful for meeting them, for knowing them, for being able to share with them. And Brittany looked me in the eyes, and she said, I love you too. Mm-hmm. And those were the last words, and her husband didn't speak. He just looked. We looked right into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a knowing in that moment. I have the chills right now in, you know, bringing this back because it was so real. That mm-hmm. moment that I would never see either one of them again. And this was our last moment. This was our last precious moment. And I was so cognizant of that, and in looking in Brittany's eyes and looking in her husband's eyes, that I knew I would never forget that, because it's something that I'll need in my life to remember the preciousness of it, because that's the stuff in this time of collapse, in this time of craziness in our world, that we have to hang on to. Precious moments, because that's what we get. We can make them bigger. We can make them stronger. We can help them grow. We can nurture them, but we can't do any of that if we let them go by without recognizing that it's happening, that precious moment is happening now, and that we can have many of them. And I realized in that moment that everything is precious. So it was was a gift.
And that's absolutely. And, you know, the main reason I wanted you to come on the show was not so much to learn the details of Brittany's passing, but to hear how, you know, from you, how your relationship with her at the end of her life impacted you, because I know it had a huge impact.
You know, after I saw Brittany the last time, I have to say that my mind was consumed. Every morning, since it was about a week and a half before Brittany died, it was the last time I had seen her. And every morning when I woke, every morning as soon as, before I opened my eyes, I thought of Brittany, and I thought, oh my God, Brittany has 4 days left, or 3 days left, 2 days left. And I realized as well that it really was impacting my life regarding, I have to say, back to the preciousness of the moments that we have here and how few of those moments she had left as her time was narrowing down. And again, I have to say it was back to the gift. I felt like I was given a gift, that in thinking of Brittany so many hours throughout every day until her passing, I was tense, and at the same time, the contrasting emotion was, she's doing exactly what she needs, and isn't that amazing, and isn't she beautiful for being able to do that, for making a choice that was the powerful decision, you know, the decision to say, I have a right to do with my world, with my body, with my family, with anything about me. I have a right to do that. I have a right to not live in pain. I have a right to choose. And her strength throughout all of those days, since the last time I saw her to her passing, were really, I don't want to necessarily say consumed, but I had a lot of interaction in my mind with what she must be going through, and I realized, I don't even know what she's going through. You know, how can I know?
Right, right.
So, yeah, it was very meditative for me during that particular week, you know, the week leading up to her passing. And I think that my level of empathy grew exponentially in that week, thinking about her mother. And, you know, what a parent must go through. I have no idea because I'm not one, but I can imagine. Knowing that these are the last moments that her daughter is going to be with her, at least in this form.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that also, Carolyn, you and I have talked about this. It led me to that whole other thought process about all that we are when we're no longer in our body. And that
right.
helped me tremendously.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that a little later on, but, you know, what you're describing to us right now is similar to what many hospice workers and palliative care people tell us all the time, that we're profoundly shaped by our experiences of working with the dying and providing end-of-life care, and it's so impactful, as you're letting us know. And I know that you're among those of many of us who believe that we're staring down near-term extinction, and as you live with death in mind, in terms of NTE, I wonder where your encounter with Brittany fits in.
Well, I look at Brittany as one small speck. Brittany had, unfortunately, had to deal with, you know, her choices. There's going to be so much more of that. So many more cases of terrible cancers. Not that any cancer is less than terrible, but some are, you know, some are, you're able to live through them, and some aren't. And I'm so concerned about the level of disease and cancers that are on the rise now due to Fukushima and nuclear power plants across the world, the result of fracking and you know, everything that is...
Right.
That we can apply to near-term human extinction. And so I actually look at Brittany and Mike, too, you know, as well. Okay.
Yeah.
They're not going to be here to see more of this. That's actually one of the things I think about quite often, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
Their end was before the main piece, at least in my view, the main piece of collapse occurring. You know, and I smile when I say that because I think they had the opportunity to get out. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to be
mm-hmm.
here to see the mainstay of that. And the mainstay of that, and my fear around that is the total devastation that is going to encompass all of us here on our planet. I mean, I think about it, and if it is accompanied by sound, it is accompanied by screams, by
yeah.
terrible moaning, by just sick illness and sickliness and the dying. And that's what I hear in my mind when I actually allow myself to hang out in the world of near-term human extinction, which, yes, I do believe in. I do believe it's occurring right now.
And, you know, just to sort of tag onto what you're saying, I just think that, you know, in terms of you're talking about the horrible cancers and different kinds of diseases, you know, for so long, those of us who've been aware of collapse and writing about it and so forth, you know, the tendency has kind of been to, well, there's going to be this big crash and this big collapse and it's going to be this point in time and, oh, my God, and we'll fall off a cliff. But what we're really looking at now in terms of near-term human extinction and catastrophic climate change is long, slow, protracted, really miserable termination of life. And through these kinds of environmental diseases, through cancers and illnesses that we've never even heard of or didn't even know were possible. And so I am totally in agreement with you about how horrible that may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's one of the ways that Brittany's death impacted me regarding near-term human extinction is, again, I have to keep going back to what is precious while I am here in my life. Right. There are times when I have to shut everything else out and look at where I'm sitting or where I'm standing and look what's around me and look at the things that I love. I love my dog. I love my partner. I love my garden. And I have to come back to that very place and say, this is my love. This is where I am. And I have to figure out a way to be okay. And I have to see this as being precious because I'm here right now. And I get to be right here right now. I'm not dying other than the fact that I was born and one day I will die, you know? Yeah. And I believe that people forget, and it's so easy to forget, and it's the goal of corporations to have us forget that we are alive.
Right.
The more alive we are, the more we can think clearly and we can love. And the more we love, the worse it is for the corporations, et cetera.
I really agree with that. And, you know, I know that you're a strong supporter of the Death with Dignity movement. And I'd like you to share with us your perspective on the various detractors from this movement who argue that people shouldn't have a right to die with dignity and that it's just suicide. And as a society, we shouldn't condone it, that it's a slippery slope that will lead to abuse of the system and legalized murder. What do you say to all of that?
You know, I have a lot of thoughts about that. There's, you know, one way of looking at it is science versus religion. You know, we have created medicines that help us, you know, not have headaches, you know, so you don't have to live with migraines or headaches. But it's not, and it's okay to take those, you know, to feel better. But it's not okay to use science or medicine to help ourselves no longer feel pain at all when the pain is so devastating that it will kill you. The pain itself can kill you, you know?
Yes.
And it's because people have their beliefs in their gods. And there is nothing in me, not one little morsel of a God thought. I feel that when God comes into the picture of rationality, there is no longer a discussion that is rational. And if someone is in pain, I want that person personally to not feel pain. If I can help them with my hands to let go of that pain, cool. If they need an anti-inflammatory of any kind, whether it's from, you know, pot to leaves, I don't care. I want them to take whatever it is that they feel comfortable taking that will help them no longer be in pain. And, of course, if they want to live their lives in pain, that's their choice. But for those of us who don't, we have a right not to, you know. And so that's really my hard line about this is that We do have an option. We all can have that option. And at one point, one day in the future, I dare the whole of the naysayers about death with dignity, when it's their turn, when they have that brain tumor that debilitates them, that crumples them to the ground in pain, and that does it at any moment, they don't know when it's coming. When that brain tumor puts them in seizures, when their bodies ache after those seizures are gone for days, I dare them to want to stay here and live through it. And if they want to, that's great. That's their choice. I want to have a different choice, and I want others to have a different choice. And religion gets in the way of that choice. I think that true religion is religion of the heart.
Absolutely.
True religion is the religion of love. True religion is not wanting your friends, your family, anyone, animals, anything, the earth, to be in pain. And that's where I'm at with that. So the discussion from the other side is, you know, to me, I would say, well, you guys really need to let yourselves open up a little bit. You know, you have to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And we know from experience that a lot of those naysayers, I don't want to stick them in a particular box. I'll just call them the naysayers to death with dignity. They have a real hard time putting them in other people's shoes themselves,
right.
You know?
Right.
Unless it happens to someone in their family. They just can't get there. And until they can get there, I think we're going to be in the same boat. And I also think that as disease becomes even more prevalent, it's hard to imagine it becoming more prevalent than it is now, but as it does become more prevalent and more debilitating, I think that many more states are going to allow death with dignity because most people have a common sense about pain.
Right.
Most people don't want pain.
Yeah.
And they want to do what they can do to alleviate pain. And if it's the final pain, meaning the final disease, and you're not going to live through that, then they should have a choice. And I think that's where we're going to get to. I believe that very much. And Brittany believed that too. And I didn't know that she had made as many videos as she has for after she died. But all of those videos that she made hours and hours of videos. Those will come out. And yeah. Brittany does live on here. And
absolutely.
Her message will live on. It's beautiful. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, Mimi, you've written a number of songs, and the one we're going to hear right now is called Did You Know That? Tell us about the song before we listen and give us a background on the lyrics.
Did You Know That was a song that was written by my music partner and I in my kitchen, and I was we were making the music, and I looked out into my garden, and I had one of those moments where I saw the beauty in the moment. Beauty in that little bit of preciousness, you know, and I put that into words as best as I could and sort of said, you know, this is a little bit about me. It's so simple, but you didn't know that because I didn't share that precious moment about myself with you. And then together we can share that because you can know a little bit more about me. And I encourage everybody to allow the people they love to hear and experience the preciousness that you feel about yourself. It's okay to feel that, and it's even more okay to share that. And this is my sharing of myself with you.
So let's listen now to Did You Know That, written and performed by Mimi Gurman.
Shooting star,
That was Did You Know That?, written and performed by Mimi Gurman. This is the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. Now, last week, Salon Magazine published an article entitled Death Should Be Optional. This article was not an argument for death with dignity, but rather an argument for the notion that eventually technology can eliminate aging and death. And it cited some thinkers like Ray Kurzweil, Hans Moravec, Michio Kaku, Marshall Brain, Aubrey de Grey, and others who foresee that technology may be able at some point to help humans make it possible to defeat death. The first thing I notice about this notion is that all of these thinkers are male. And the second thing I notice is that this perspective is like American death phobia on steroids. When we talk about death with dignity and a person choosing to surrender to death, we're suggesting a relinquishment of power and control and an opening to the natural process of endings and beginnings. And it seems like the Western mind, especially the mind that cannot surrender to nature, cannot grasp death as a part of life. What do you say to that?
Oh, well, first I have to laugh in the face of it because its entire premise lies in the fact, denies the fact that nuclear power plants are not going to come crumbling down due to drought, you know, just for one, right. That climate change in and of itself isn't going to take the entire planet down. You know, it's like, oh, how is that going to be accomplished when there's no earth to live on? So that's why I was laughing. I think that's funny. But I think I understand men and their need for dominance and control. And that's what that's based on. You know, we can create our godness, our manliness in power, and we can make us live till forever, even when there's no planet here. And it's a ridiculous notion because we won't have a planet to live on. And it's as simple as that. I mean, when you really understand near-term human extinction, there's nothing that can be done to fix anything. You can't create more human life when there's nothing to live on.
Yeah, and artificial intelligence isn't going to cut it either. I mean, you know.
No, you have melted computers, melted robots. I mean, people forget that the heat level of the planet or the cold level, depending on, you know, how things are moving, is going to be so extreme that there won't be life here. And, it's a grab into the mystic, into a fake mystic of what can be. And an absolute denial of what is. And nature is what is. And when we mess with nature, which we've done, and we've done it really well, we no longer get nature. And without nature, there's no life. You know, show me a tree that lived till forever. What does that look like? We won't see that. It doesn't happen. And men surely can't make this happen. But they've been really good at making the opposite occur. I think they should do a companion article on the opposite.
You talk about the flat earth perspective versus the perspective that we live in many layers. You were alluding to this a while ago. Would you expand on this in relation to death and your connection with Brittany?
Yeah, I did talk with Brittany about this. Just to add something to her, you know, if she wasn't aware or hadn't thought about this, for me, when I was young, I started to look into plant medicines because they had the ways and means to show us what is beyond our, you know, our body, our human form. And I learned very early on that we are not of our body. That's one piece of us. But we're connected to a huge organism, a huge living organism that goes beyond Earth. It goes out into the solar system. The stardust is what I like to call it, you know, where I'm from. I'm made of stardust.
Yeah.
And And having that awareness that my energy is only, you know, at the moment is contained for the most part within my body, that parts of my energy that are within my body can go out to my thought process beyond my body and affect change and difference into the world beyond my body, that's comforting to me. That's a powerful awareness that I have that helps me through. You know, I can't imagine thinking that I was just of my body, that when my eyes are closed, I can't even feel anything outside of me. I can feel many things outside of me, and then beyond that. And we all could if we decided to stop believing, really, that the earth is still flat, which is what it seems like to me. It seems that way all the time. When we read articles like that, the one that you just mentioned, you know, let's make artificial intelligence and humans live until the beyond, when there is no beyond. That's right. A flat earth concept to me. That's not what is. And what is isn't what most people think is either. You know, what is that we're human, we're born, and then we die. I've had an awareness that I've shared with some people because I find it comforting, and that is when I die, the energy that is stored in my body will expand. It will go out into the wherever, and it will connect with the energy out there and become one with all of that. Part of me is still connected to all of that that is, even while I'm alive, while my energy is also inside me. I have an awareness that there really is no such thing as death. The body dies, and that's it. There's no hell. There's no heaven. There's expansion of energy that's no longer trapped in a body. And I find that beautiful. I don't find that desolate. I don't find that full of despair. I don't find that leaving me feeling like I want more. I feel a part of such a larger whole. And that's, again, it's comforting. It's one of my precious pieces of awareness. And I do think that if other people, the people who I like to refer to as having flat earth consciousness, if they would allow themselves to open and allow themselves to look at plant medicine and experience plant medicine, they'd see that too. And when you see that you're a part of the infinite whole, all it is, you really don't think about things like making war and making corporations to take over and have power over, because it doesn't make sense anymore. And we're living on a planet with people now where I think the collective consciousness, unfortunately, still, I think it's changing. We're at a little bit of a changing point, though. It's far too late. The collective consciousness is still that of flat earth, and that we're not part of a larger whole. And I would love for us to be able to rise and get to that place, just to see what that would feel like, having all of us be part of a different paradigm, one that is guided by love, not ruled by. There's no rulers in my thought process around this. We're guided by love because we're part of the infinite whole.
Well, I love what you say about the expansiveness, and you know that expansiveness is infinite, and it's connected with everyone and everything, and that, you know, it's like we don't go to heaven or hell; we go into a different state of consciousness. And everybody who's had a near-death experience and returned has said something about feeling unconditional love. That wherever that place is, whatever it's like, it's one of unconditional love. So one of the things that I don't want to overlook in our conversation, in the sense in which you're a hospice, is the sense in which you're a hospice worker. In the sense in which you continually raise our awareness about the deadly ongoing aftermath of Fukushima. And I really do believe that that your work in raising our awareness about radiation is in a sense palliative care. I sometimes think of you as the Paula Revere of radiation. Essentially, you're announcing the death of the planet and our personal deaths. So what's it like for you to be looking at this so up close and personal and to be speaking these horrible truths to humanity?
Well, fortunately, first of all, there are many of us speaking those truths. And if I were doing it alone, boy, that would be a heavy burden. But I'm so glad to say that I'm not.
Yes.
There are many of us who see the truth. And, you know, I think that one of the main questions, and I've heard you say this, and I've also heard Guy refer to this, and people say, well, if you think that near-term human extinction is happening, then why do anything? And my answer to that is, why not? We're still here. Why not try to do something just for the sake of doing something positive? You know, it's not going to change the masses. It's not going to change, you know, rapid climate change. But it will do something just for us, for our spirit, you know. So I believe in trying to continue to make positive change for the sake of making positive change. It all doesn't need that perfect outcome. We're not going to have a perfect outcome. And in the end, regardless of rapid climate change or not, we all die. So why not do something that's positive? And on that note, I feel very strongly that if people can gain an understanding that we have things that are happening on the planet that do not need to be happening, that those very things are the things that are going to kill us quicker, and we have something to say about it, and we can change that, then why not put that out, you know? And I guess for me, it becomes a little bit easier knowing why I'm doing it. I think sometimes the burnout range might be a little bit, it might happen more frequently to the workers, the truth speakers, if they're not sure why they're doing it. And for me, I can't speak to why they do or don't do what they do. I'm glad they're doing it anyway. But for me, just knowing that I'm into positive change for now, just because, that helps me. It helps me tell people, look, you know, we've got droughts happening, and we have nuclear power plants that need water. They need so much water that we no longer have on the earth to accommodate them, that they're going to melt down. And when you say it like that, I think it jogs somebody's mind for a moment and pulls them off, you know, flat earth consciousness. And when you tell them that you actually have a say and you might be able to help in this process if you come on board, then maybe they will. But I also don't do what I do to make people do anything. I do it for me. I do it because I love the planet, you know, and I do it because I'm here. And what else am I going to do? You know, I mean, I could just sit outside and enjoy the beauty of my garden and not do anything, but that's just not who I am. You know, I feel that we have a responsibility when that consciousness rises up in us that lets us know that we are a part of the whole, that we are a part of infinite, of the infinite, that we are a part of infinite wisdom, that we have to use that and share that. You know, we can't pretend not to know once we know, and we can't be quiet once we know, and we can't pretend that ignorance is okay. And that's, you know, that's the stuff that drives me, balanced by seeing my dog, knowing she needs to eat, be loved, go outside, and enjoy the weather, you know? It's balance.
And I also think that, you know, as we live out near-term extinction, however that looks, that in addition to service, in addition to doing things because it's the right thing to be doing at the time, there's something to be said for bearing witness. Bearing witness to the suffering, bearing witness to all of these gigantic changes that are happening and the destruction of the planet. And I'm a fan of a guy named Bernie Glassman, who He's a Zen Buddhist peacemaker, and he does two things that I find really amazing. He takes regular middle-class people for 2 weeks on street retreats, which is they go out into New York City and they live as homeless people. They interact with homeless people. They don't know where their food is going to come from. They don't know where they're going to sleep. Another thing he does is he takes a group of people every November to Auschwitz, and they spend time there in a silent vigil, meditating, really deeply connecting with each other. And the whole purpose of all of this is bearing witness. And there's a quote from Bernie that I really want to read because it so speaks to what we're talking about. He says, when we bear witness, when we become the situation, homelessness, poverty, illness, violence, death, the right action arises by itself. We don't have to worry about what to do. We don't have to figure out solutions ahead of time. Peacemaking is the functioning of bearing witness. Once we listen with our entire body and mind, loving action arises. Loving action is right action. It's as simple as giving a hand to someone who stumbles or picking up a child who's fallen on the floor. We take such direct, natural actions every day of our lives without considering them special, and they're not special. Each is simply the best possible response to that situation in the moment.
It's
so,
beautiful.
Do you have any thoughts about bearing witness?
Yeah, I do. A long time ago, maybe 3 years ago, a friend of mine who lives on uranium land out in northern Saskatchewan, it's covered by uranium fields, and most of the people up there have died or are dying currently. And fortunately, my friend and his wife at the moment do not have cancer, but he said to me, he's a native Canadian, and he said to me, you know, all you can do is witness. And I didn't understand that 3 years ago, and I remembered it. I questioned him. I talked to him about this. We went back and forth, and I said, but, you know, what about this? Can't we do this? And he just kept responding by saying, we are witnesses. And I thought that because I wanted to, I thought that by doing, there was a difference in doing and bearing witness. And what I realized 3 years later was that witnessing is doing. And it's doing so much. And I, you know, the quote that you just read is so beautiful because I've been living that personally now here in Portland. And it's just true, you know. I make it a point to speak to homeless people I see sitting on the ground and against the building and asking them what they need. And when you do that, when you connect to somebody, you will always do the right thing. And I was smiling as you were reading that. But yeah, I had a big issue with being a witness because I didn't think it was doing anything, and I'm a doer. And when I realized that I was a witness, and not only that I was witnessing, but that it was doing so much in a different kind of realm, I wrote to my friend, and I said, you're right. We're witnessing, and I'm a witness, and we witness this together. And it was a big realization. It's still hard for me to even wrap words around. So your friend did it better, you know.
Well, I love that you just said so clearly. Witnessing is doing. Witnessing is doing. I had never really put it in those words, but thank you for that. I mean, that is so absolutely on spot on.
Yeah, it took me, like I said, it took me 3 years, post-Fukushima, 3 years to figure this out. And there is, again, it's one of those comfort moments when you recognize that witnessing, there's no just before it. It's not just witnessing as if it's less than something else. It is witnessing. It is an act of witnessing. It is an act of doing by witnessing. And I'm so glad I got there. And my friend was glad, too. He wrote me back. He just sent me a smile. That's all he did.
Well, you know, yeah, we have talked about, we have just a few minutes left, and we've talked about a really important idea here, a concept that we haven't really named. When we were back talking about the guys that want to get rid of death, we didn't talk about the word surrender. And surrender is not giving up. Surrender is opening to something greater. And what we're called upon to do right now is to love life with every fiber of our being and at the same time be able to surrender. And I don't know anyone who says what I'm trying to say better than Mary Oliver in her poem, Blackwater Woods. And so I'd like to finish with that poem, if I may. Here's Mary Oliver's Blackwater Woods, which is so relevant to what Mimi has been sharing with us. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Everything I've ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. Love what is mortal. Hold it against your bones, knowing your life depends on it. And when the time comes, to let it go, to let it go. Thank you so much, Mimi Gurman, for being with us. And we hope to have you again on the Lifeboat Hour soon.
Thank you, Carolyn. I love you. Thank you for your show. Thank you for your words.
Likewise. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We will see you again next week.
Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.